This episode is sponsored by
Dorothy and Alicia Berry CPR, AHA certified BLS instructors preparing individuals to have a safe and healthy experience as they travel abroad by reviewing healthcare strategies and first aid techniques.
Welcome to Your Expat Expert Podcast, where we provide expatriate services to individuals and companies moving abroad in an educational environment with an informative voice, helping you feel confident and, more importantly, prepared. As you prepare to take this journey to study, work, volunteer, or retire abroad, subscribe to Your Expat Expert Podcast to minimize the nobody told me or I didn't know moments. Now let's begin with a smoother transition. On today's show, we will be discussing traveling abroad in the medical field with Ms. Sharon M. Weinstein, who has traveled multiple countries in the medical field. You've taught in 14 countries, is that correct?
Yes, I have. 14 countries and in every state and province.
Wow, that's amazing. Thank you for coming on the show.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So if you could just tell me about your international experience. So how would one apply for a traveling abroad in a medical field?
First of all, I'll tell you how I got started working abroad. As a nurse, I worked in the field of intravenous therapy and IV nutrition support, which is a nursing subspecialty. It deals with drug administration, fluid administration, chemotherapy, blood, and more, using the vessels of the circulatory system. I became an expert in that field, and I served as the president of the Infusion Nurses Society nationally. Okay. During that term, I was invited for the very first time to teach IV therapy and nutrition support in the People's Republic of China in 5 provinces. And when I first saw the invitation, I remember saying to my husband, oh, I can't go. There's no way that I can go. I have you and I have 3 little kids. I just can't do this. But maybe I could recommend someone. And my husband looked at me and said, why don't you recommend yourself? You're the most qualified person to go. And if you don't go now, you may never have another chance to see China.
That's true.
I'll take care of the kids.
Oh, wow.
And I thought, wow, what a great opportunity. And off I went for 3.5 weeks, leading a delegation of 25 other professionals to the People's Republic of China, to Wuxi and to Guangzhou and Beijing and Nanjing. And it was amazing. It was an amazing experience to be able to see the hospitals firsthand, to understand the culture, to see how healthcare differed from a standpoint of resources, but was so very much like we do from a standpoint of spirit and passion and why people went into healthcare in the first place.
Okay.
And I discovered that nurses, no matter where they are or where they're from or where they've trained, all share the same spirit, and that is one of engaging to take care of others and to make their lives more satisfactory, hopefully with better outcomes. So that was how I started. And from there, I had multiple invitations every year. So it was China, it was the former Soviet Union, it was Egypt, it was Australia and New Zealand, it was Berlin, East and West Berlin, Frankfurt, Dusseldorf, and everywhere else in Frankfurt. It was Belgium. Just there were so many places.
Mm-hmm.
And I totally got hooked, if you will.
Yes.
The way that many people do. They go abroad, they see another culture, they see another people whose spirit and life is very much like their own, but in a different part of the world. And they become close to people and they engage in relationships with them and they become collaborators on various projects and they decide, wow, this is really for me. This is something that I could get used to. So I did that sort of a thing for probably a good 10 years or so when I had the unique opportunity to direct the Office of International Affairs for 1,800 U.S. hospitals, partnering those hospitals with their counterparts in the former Soviet Union and in Central and Eastern Europe. And that was 50% of my job. It was supposed to be 20 to 30 hours a week. It turned out to be 50 to 70. And for the rest of my job, the other 30 hours equaling 100, I was supposed to work Australia, New Zealand, the United Kingdom, Cape Verde, West Africa, and a half a dozen other countries. And I jumped at the opportunity to take that job. Initially, I was up against 6 physicians for the job, each of whom needed somebody to arrange for their visa, to carry their bags, to pack their bag, to take care of them, to hold their hand.
Right.
To order their food, to make sure that their clothes had been pressed and their shoes had been shined. And I was the only one who showed up and said, I can do this. And it doesn't matter where I get stranded or when,
I will make
do
it happen. Yes.
And I did make it happen. That's exactly what happened. And so I had that opportunity, and I did that job for probably a good 12 years or so. And in the process, forged so many more relationships than I ever thought possible. And so my passion is for creating the opportunity for others to expand their own horizons and to excel in their own fields, most of which are healthcare, because that's the arena in which I work, but to really allow them to be themselves, to empower them to be more than they ever could imagine. So I've taken nurses who went to nursing school for 12 months and brought them through a doctoral program where they now suddenly speak English and can testify before the Department of Health and Human Services here in DC. Mm-hmm. These are amazing professionals who are now the Ministry of Health chief nurses and the Ministry of Education chief and heaven knows whatever else. They're amazing professionals, and to have been a small part in their development is truly overwhelming.
Wow. It's a blessing to be able to talk to you about all your experiences and with the passion that you have. But at the same time, based off your experience, what is your biggest challenge?
The biggest challenge for me early on in 1992, when I started the job with hospitals, was that nurses in particular were what we call middle-level personnel.
Okay.
They weren't doctors, so they didn't count in the big scheme of things. Mm-hmm. And they didn't have the same credibility as an accountant or a manager, if you will. Mm-hmm. They were just middle-level people who made beds, who cooked food, who mopped floors.
Okay.
And so to take that profession to a level that enabled them to have licensure and certification and credentials mm-hmm. and competencies was huge. I think the biggest challenge was not having the nurses believe in themselves and what was possible for them, but to have their chiefs, each of whom were physicians, believe
they
that somebody else could do something.
Right.
So a good example is once we used lots of government funds to open a nursing resource center in Kazakhstan. And when we installed this in Kazakhstan, and it had computers and printers and internet and all kinds of capabilities, it was amazing. The doctors locked the door and said, the nurses can't have this. It also had a nursing simulation lab with mannequins. And they said, they're not allowed to have this because we don't have it. This is going to be the medical resource lab. So I think a lot of what I dealt with at the time initially was the concept of mindset and shifting that mindset among co-collaborators and other professionals, the interprofessionals, who could recognize the fact that if they helped nurses, nurses would help the system.
Absolutely.
And that would help patients and people would get better and everyone would win.
Oh, wow. And you started your own company. You have actually two companies.
I do.
Yes. And how did that evolve based off your experience?
My experiences were such that I was an employee like everybody else working in a job. In most cases, a job is considered to be just over broke. For me, it was not. Yes. I made a lot of money. Mm-hmm. I worked a lot of hours and I probably had the greatest reward, and that was the ability to collaborate with my peers abroad. That was huge for me. It was such a reward that money wouldn't have mattered. It was so big. But from that, I decided to form a consulting company that is called SMW Group, that stands for So Many Ways Toward Health and Well-Being, and another company called the Global Education Development Institute.
Okay.
When I was running this program in the former Soviet Union, I partnered with, of course, all of my own hospitals, each of whom had a chief nurse. Mm-hmm. And I asked my board members for the names of those nurses who would be most willing to work abroad and to help me to build my program. And I had volunteers come out of the woodwork. Everyone wanted the opportunity. Everyone looked at that as, this is something I've been waiting for my entire career. And I chose the six best professionals, the best of the best, who were my former chief nurses, and invited them to be a part of my board of the Global Education Development Institute. So that instead of going to the former Soviet Union once a month, as they often did, maybe they go twice a year, and maybe in between they go to somewhere in South Africa or in West Africa, where they might be going instead to Armenia or to the United Kingdom or even to Barcelona. They're going to another country on behalf of our organization and educating others.
Okay. Okay. Well, we're going to take a break. So we will be back with Ms. Sharon Weinstein.
Dorothy and Alicia Berry, CPR, AHA certified BLS instructors, we encourage all to learn the basics and save a life. We can be reached at 202 696-6173 or 202-200-9684 or via Facebook at facebook.com/ADJ.
We're back with Sharon M. Weinstein. So we're back and I want to talk to you about something else, some of your experiences. And I was wondering if you ever had any trouble in other countries. Were you ever in trouble in other countries?
I absolutely found myself in trouble in another country. And probably the biggest trouble I found myself in, other than the problems that we all have related to flights and seating and tickets and all kinds of things, delays in which there you have a ticket but there's not going to be a plane, or someone has decided you should sit in the airport for 7 hours, those things don't matter. Mm-hmm. What probably mattered to me the most was I was the guest of the president of the Russian Federation Medical Center in Sochi, Russia, long before anyone ever heard of the Olympics and Sochi. No one ever put them in the same sentence. And so in Sochi, it was always a seaside resort for people from the Russian Federation. Of course, there was one section that was for the wealthier people, the more distinguished people.
Right.
Very high level government sanatoria that would be the equivalent perhaps of a Waldorf or something else, very high end. And then the regular sanatoria with regular apartments where other people might go with their families, rent a little place, go to a beach cottage, and enjoy the beach for 2 to 3 weeks. During that time, people are also required to enter into a sports physiology program and exercise. They're required to see a nutritionist and to eat properly. So the whole idea is that in addition to rest, you also take the time to take care of yourself.
Okay.
And when I was initially invited, it was for 24 days, but of course I don't go anywhere for 24 days. And I offered my guests 4 to 5 days of my time and said I'd be happy to go.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went, I was met at the airport by some dignitaries and whisked away in a special black car and felt like the queen of who knows what, and was taken to this gated community in the government sanatoria building. And I was next to the highest level dignitary in the Russian Federation government.
Wow.
And everything was fine. They assigned a dietologist, who was the equivalent of a dietitian, who came to talk to me about what I wanted to eat and what would be good for me given my hereditary cholesterol problem. And then they assigned a sports physiologist who took me down to a gym for training and had me climbing poles on walls and doing all kinds of things that she thought would be good for me.
Okay.
And then they assigned me someone to take me fishing so that I could see what kinds of fish came from the sea and how exciting that would be. And after, of course, the first 24 hours of downtime, I was bored. And I figured that it would probably be in my best interest to leave the compound and go out for a walk. See how people live. Mm-hmm. See what they do. See what kinds of shops were available.
Experience the culture.
Maybe there was some souvenir shopping to be done. Mm-hmm. The money was surely burning a hole in my pocket.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went outside the gates and I went down the street for a walk. And I'm sure that I walked maybe half a mile to a mile or so.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw this amazing traffic accident. And I thought to myself, wow, this is just like Chicago. The cars are backed up from here to eternity. No one is going anywhere fast. All of the gawkers are turning around to look to see who got hit and who got hurt. And traffic is not moving and the police are there and the ambulances are there and it was a mess. And I whipped out my trusty camera and took a couple of photographs, thinking to myself, this would be powerful for a PowerPoint presentation in the future that dealt with the concept of challenges. Traffic is a problem no matter where you are.
Absolutely.
Whether you're separated by 5,000 miles or miles and mountains, mm-hmm. traffic can still be a problem, whether it's bicycles in Beijing mm-hmm. or cars in Russia. And so I took the picture, and I'm not sure 10 seconds passed when two very able-bodied gentlemen came up beside me mm-hmm. in plain clothes, very muscular, grabbed me by the arms and pushed me into a car and told me that I was under arrest.
Wow.
Now, of course, my Russian was somewhat limited. By then, I had probably studied 2 weeks or so. I knew mm-hmm. a few words. They usually dealt with things like buying groceries or ordering off of a
right.
menu. They didn't deal with going to jail, mm-hmm. being arrested, being behind bars, and having no resources.
Mm-hmm.
And I was taken to the police station and fingerprinted.
Mm.
My camera was taken from me along with the film, and I was basically told that I had no rights
mm-hmm.
because I was in another country and had violated the law.
Mm-hmm.
And lucky for me, I had a phone number.
And what phone number was that?
The number that I had was of the United States Embassy in Moscow, where the chief of the medical unit was a friend of mine who had worked with me on my hospital project. It was very easy to get through. I am telling you that no matter where you go, no matter where you are, you should never, ever, ever think about traveling to another country without having numbers to call, resources. You have to have your people. You have to have your names. If it's possible, you should have the name of an English-speaking physician or an English-speaking nurse or someone who can help you out of some sort of a predicament. And it was the doctor from the embassy who got me out that very evening. He called my colleague from the Government Federation. They called the police station, and I was out probably in a good 8 to 10 hours that might have taken 8 to 10 days had I not had that resource. Okay. Wow. And I got my camera back, not the film, but yeah, I got the camera.
I was going to ask you, did you get the film?
I got the camera, no film.
Oh, wow. So that can be scary, but...
I was frightened.
A lesson's learned.
But it was a good lesson learned. I mean, I've been frightened before. I've been in places when I've thought, what did I get myself into and where have I been and where is my GPS when I need one? In those days, there was no GPS. Right. There was no Dora the Explorer to tell you where to go with a map. It was pretty much using your own gut feeling about what's right and what's wrong and using your intellect and your intuition and knowing that it's possible to feel unsafe on your own street corner, in your own town, wherever you live. And it's easily as possible to feel the same way in a country in which you don't know the culture, you don't know the language, you don't know the people.
Right. Well, thank you for sharing the time when you get in trouble with the country. But if you can provide any advice on how to, or provide a resource, or how to save time and stress, What would it be for that individual?
I think there are two ways to look at this. You can travel abroad for a short period of time. It can be for a sabbatical. It can be for a study session. It can be for 2 weeks. It can be for vacation. Or you can travel abroad and live in another country for a significant period of time. In my work, I also employed nurses who worked for me from the United States in the government hospital.
Okay.
So I had a nurse once from Russia, from Rochester, New York, and I had a nurse once from DC, from GW. And they were full-time employees who worked in two hospitals, 3 days in one and 2 days in another. They had an apartment, they had a car, they had a driver, they had a good budget.
Right.
They were well paid at US salary. They were given a certain number of days to return to the United States, but in order to avoid paying taxes, they had to make sure that they stayed abroad for the right number of days.
330 days.
Exactly, in order to avoid having to pay tax on these significant earnings that they were making. So for example, my nurse from Rochester was hopeful that she would get paid at least Rochester, New York wages. I paid her Chicago wages, which were three times what people from Rochester would make.
Wow.
Plus, she had housing, she had food, she had everything. So when you start to look at it, it becomes quite lucrative. When I think about placing people abroad or being there myself, and I've been gone for as long as 6 months at a time, never much longer than that, I think that probably the most important thing that one needs to know is, who are my resources? What do I need to know about housing, about culture, about language, about not making myself feel lonely? Even when a family is moving abroad, if a family is moving abroad and say it's either the husband or the wife who is being transferred to work for another company, the other person probably is going to be staying at home with kids.
Yes.
And how does that make you feel? Yes, you might all go into that training program in which they teach you a little bit about the culture and the language and habits and everything else about that country, what to order, what to do, how to shop. I remember how hard it was for me the first time to pay a phone bill. I had to find the right bank with a green awning. I had to have the right money. I had to have the right piece of paper. I had to wait in line for close to 4.5 hours.
And even your spouse's career is stagnant if they don't have a plan in place when they move abroad.
Exactly. So number one, you're right. Their position is stagnant. But number two, you're there and you're lonely. And if your spouse spends a lot of time at work or interacting with the people from his or her work, what are you doing besides staying home all day, or knitting, or creating something, or painting, or weaving, or doing pottery? What else are you going to do? How do you integrate the community? How do you break into those groups of international women or men abroad who have social activities and things in which you can participate, who do outings, who have cultural events, who have book clubs, who have people to talk to and not go stir crazy?
Right.
So I think that I would recommend that people have what I refer to as a loneliness plan.
Okay.
What am I going to do to overcome the challenge of being by myself or with someone but still alone in a foreign land? That's number one. Number two, I would encourage everyone to get some level of language skills. It can be as basic can be. But there's a big difference between somebody who knows what seat to ask for on a plane or on a train and someone who does not.
Mm-hmm.
Between somebody who knows how to ask for yogurt with skim milk in the grocery store rather than with whole milk. I remember the first time I decided to have a dinner party in my apartment in Moscow, and I went shopping for groceries, and I was inviting four Russian doctors, and they wanted to have a dish that they had heard of but had never tasted.
Okay.
And it was mastacholi. It was Italian.
Okay.
Well, I'm not Italian, but I can cook a few things out of a recipe book. I could easily do that. But they wanted mastacholi. And I knew that to make mastacholi, I needed, at a minimum, peppers and tomatoes, pasta, and ground meat. I started out with the meat. It was the most important ingredient. I went to the grocery store. No one had ever heard of ground meat. They had no idea what I was talking about. And so I looked under the sink in my rickety old apartment, and I found something that looked like a vise that somebody would have used to cut pipe long ago. And I realized that it connected to the bottom of the kitchen counter and to the top, and that it had a funnel. And that if I put the meat in there, after, of course, I washed the thing, who knows how many years it had been sitting there, that I could put the meat in there and it would
grind it up
and I would have ground meat. And then I found a place where they actually had homemade pasta, and I found a place to buy ingredients to bake bread, and I found a few other things and bought a bunch of tomatoes and made dinner, and they all thought it was spectacular. I thought it was probably the worst meal that I had ever made, but there were so many kudos about how great this meal was, and I felt really proud of myself for being able to set the table and invite people over. Most of the furnishings at the table itself, with the linens and the dishes, I had bought at a flea market the Sunday before. But I felt great because I was able to produce something that took me back to the concept of creativity.
Yes. And it took the entire day to get your items.
It took more than a day. It took more than a day. It took a really long time. It was probably the equivalent of going to have a key made, which took me 2 or 3 days and a train and a bus and a few other things just to be able to have a duplicate key made. Everything becomes so time consuming.
Yes.
So I think that it's important to recognize the fact that if you allow yourself a certain amount of time to do things that would take you, say, an hour and a half at home, you have to allow 6 to 10 hours or more in certain countries to be able to accomplish the same thing, and then to feel really good at the end of the day that you got it done.
Yes.
So you need to reward yourself with something, knowing that it took a long time and that you managed to make it happen.
Even though it was simple.
It could have been as simple can be, but everything is more complex when there are barriers. I remember one time I had a contract to build a clinic, and I needed to have it signed by my colleagues in the Russian Federation. And because it was a government institution and they owned a lot of facilities, my counterpart had to drive to each one of those facilities and schmooze with the people over a bottle of vodka and a piece of fish for several hours to coerce them to even talk to me about signing the agreement. And I was in Chicago, and I would call and say, why don't you just fax it over to them, ask them to fax it back to you with the signature.
No, it doesn't work that way.
And they said, there is no such thing.
Mm-hmm.
My responsibility is to first be their friend.
Yes.
And once the relationship is there, and I've established the relationship and trust in you, then I can get them to sign off on something. And by the way, it might take me 3 to 5 weeks.
Yeah.
And so while I was sitting on the seat of my pants thinking, gosh, my counterparts in Chicago are eager for this contract, they want to move ahead and get things done, I need to recognize the fact that I need to be patient.
Yes.
And that's another virtue, working abroad. So the loneliness plan, patience. That everything is not going to happen tomorrow. Or I remember my colleague saying to me once, Sharon, be patient. In our country, everything is possible, but not everything is probable.
Right.
differentiate your two words. Okay. It might not work the way you want it to work, but we can make it work. So I think flexibility is key. I think that you have to recognize that it is not going to be the glamour and the drama that you expect it to be, because that's the way it is in all the magazines or on TV or movies. It looks very glamorous. Yes. Well, it's not so glamorous. Mm-hmm. It's not so glamorous when your pipes break in your apartment and you have no idea who to call to fix. Or it's not so glamorous when, well, I guess you should be happy that there's a fire alarm in the building, but the fire alarm goes off and you haven't figured out where the emergency exit is from your building or where to go once you get down to the street. Mm-hmm. It's not so glamorous when you're waiting in line and that the grocery store is out of food by the time that you get to the front of the line and you don't know what you're going to do. And it's not so glamorous when you're in a place for 6 weeks, as I was once in the Republic of Armenia in the winter of 92, with no heat, no hot water, no running water, and the snow coming into my hotel room as fast as it was coming down. Wow. And you had to sleep in your coat, your boots, your hat, your gloves, your scarf, and everything else to try to maintain warmth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they're not going to tell you that.
No one's going to tell you that. Those pieces. My favorite story is from a nurse who was a colleague of mine at the Emergency Scientific Medical Center in Yerevan, which had a partnership with Worcester, Massachusetts, and it was about 911 and emergency medicine being first responders. Of course, in Armenia, we had to siphon the gas out of the cars and put it into our ambulance to be able to go and save a patient. And the ambulance always had thousands of cracks in the glass in the front window, so you never knew if you were going to arrive or not. Well, I remember this young lady, Rosanna, working with me, and the first place that I met her, she was mopping the floor, she was making the lunch. The lunch had been sitting on the windowsill for days, and it looked like a penicillin experiment. They called it pizza, but it was a piece of bread with something red on it.
Okay.
And clearly there was mold on the top.
Oh.
And if that was going to be good enough for them to eat, how could I possibly say, well, gee, that doesn't look good enough for me to eat? Mm-hmm. So there were times when I ate things that I knew were going to make me ill, but I ate them to be polite because it was the right thing to do. But I remember Rosanna waiting on me hand and foot, and she wasn't allowed to sit at the same table as me because I was a foreigner and I was a nurse and I had credibility and I had respect, and she was the middle level personnel. Fast forward 10 years, and Rosanna has now graduated from my International Nursing Leadership Institute, and she's a nursing leader with the best of them. Mm-hmm. She's now the chief nurse in charge of postgraduate education for her republic. And she comes to a meeting with me, and she sits right down next to me at lunch and says, you know, I want you to realize that I still love you. I will always love you. The reason that I couldn't be with you was because I was not a professional. And now I am.
Wow.
And you made me that way. How big is that?
You changed her life.
What more thanks can you possibly get than that?
Wow. That's so gratifying,
huge.
Yes.
It's huge.
Wow. That's all I can say.
It's just huge. So there are so many situations in which you talk about being prepared for things. I think it's important to be tenacious. I think it's important to be resilient. I think it's important. People joke about Tom Hanks in the movie Sully, and that he was also in that FedEx movie, and that sometimes it's not good to travel where Tom Hanks is traveling. Well, let me tell you, I was in Tiananmen Square during the uprising, and I was in Russia at the White House when the Russian White House was burning and had to be evacuated out of that country. So sometimes people would say to me, well, I'm not traveling with you either, because I was on a plane once that lost its fuselage over Siberia and had to land in Vienna. And it was supposed to be landing in Tokyo. So I think that each time, if we view this, A, as an adventure from which we may or may not return, but which will clearly enrich our lives and the lives of others in powerful ways, that in itself is what makes it all worthwhile. And I've been fortunate in that a couple of times I got to take my daughters to travel with me. When I was speaking for the WHO in Amsterdam, I was able to take my daughter. I went to a two-hour meeting and I spent the rest of the time with her, and it was fabulous. And then I presented a paper in Paris once with a group of my nurses, and it was on the acculturation of nurses acclimating to life in the United States and what was different in terms of what they did in their own country. And my daughter, who's a clinical psychologist, did the attenuation studies for me, and she presented with me in Paris, France. That was amazing just to be able to do that. I helped my niece once adopt a little boy from St. Petersburg, Russia, from an orphanage. And when I met the little boy, he was 6 weeks old. We handpicked him. She adopted him 3 months later, but for the first 3 months, he let me go to the orphanage and feed him each time. And now I look at him and he's a freshman at Penn State, and I think, wow, I helped create this. Mm-hmm. I helped Pam to adopt this child who has given her life in the same way in which she has given him life. That's big.
Yes.
So I think that each of us has to realize that this is a calling. It's not for everyone. Not everyone can work abroad and appreciate the true value of the learning experience. In my mind, I think the most important thing to remember, whether you're in healthcare or whether you're in any field, engineering, it doesn't matter, is that at all times everyone is both student and teacher. And we have as much to learn from our colleagues as they from us.
Absolutely.
And the important thing is that when they come to visit us in our own country, to make sure that you say to them, look at what you see and take back perhaps what you can adapt to your own country. Please don't copy our mistakes.
Right.
Because we have our own. Mm-hmm. So you asked the question about how do people get started on this journey. I would encourage people to go to www.gedinfp, which stands for notforprofit.com.
Okay.
So it's the Global Education Development Institute. Mm-hmm. And we are the trusted partners in growing the next generation of healthcare professionals abroad in multiple countries. Our board has worked in probably close to about 11 countries right now. We have 3 active projects in place. We're always looking for co-collaborators, for people who want to work with us to expand their own horizons, but to also expand the learning curve for others. So that's a huge opportunity. There are so many other programs. We have a Hallmark book that we've published through Getty. And it's called Nursing Without Borders, Values, Wisdom, and Success Markers. It's available on our website. And in it, we have stories because I issued the template to 26 nurses from 30 countries. And each of them followed those templates to explain the challenges, the tribulations, the rewards of working abroad and what it meant for their own projects. Mm-hmm. And so half of it is in American English and half of it is in British English. And it's a brilliant book that took us 6 weeks to write, which I think is amazing dealing with that many different authors. But we're very proud of it, and we're very often asked to present programs on working within borders and beyond borders. What does that mean?
Okay.
Where will that take us? How does it expand my own horizon, my own wealth of knowledge, my own ability to be perhaps more tolerant of people at home?
Yes.
Because when you think about it, we are a country of immigrants.
Yes,
everyone here
yes.
in this very new country has come from another place.
Mm-hmm.
So when I meet people from abroad, I'll usually say, what country did your family come from?
Okay.
Because it's the more polite thing to say. I won't say what part of China are you from, because they might be Korean or Japanese, and
yes.
I don't want to offend. But I'll usually say, from what part of Asia did your family come? And Asia could also mean the Central Asian Republics in Russia, because half of Russia is in Asia, which is why it's called Eurasia. But I'll usually say that, and when they say, well, why are you asking? And I'll say, because, you know, my husband's family emigrated from Western Ukraine in 1909 to the eastern townships of Canada. And my own family also came both from Russia and Ukraine during different times.
Okay.
But we're such a new country that we've all come from somewhere. And being that great big melting pot that is so multicultural, each of us has something special to bring.
Yes.
When I was working as the director of the Office of International Affairs, once a month we had a multicultural luncheon. And even among the staff, so that they could have a better understanding of the kinds of people who I brought in to visit us, and the kinds of people who were participating from their own departments in some of my trips, each of them was asked to bring in a lunch to share that was from a country from which one of their ancestors had come.
Wow.
So we had Irish dishes and Polish sausage and this and that and the other. And it was just a huge tasting party, big enough for about 300 to 400 people. And it was pretty amazing. And people got to stand up and give some information about where they heard their grandparents or their great grandparents had come from and how long they'd been in this country and what they had learned about their culture or what they wish they had learned. And often it inspired many of them to go back to their parents and to their grandparents and to say to them, tell me a little bit more about the old country.
Yes.
Because people are always talking about the old country, but the old country can mean any one of a number of things. Mm-hmm. to any one of a number of people. It's pretty exciting when you realize that we're so new.
Oh, yes.
And yet we have so many different cultures living within our borders that we could study international challenges and healthcare and concepts right at home, especially in the District of Columbia.
All it takes is a conversation. Yeah.
That's all it takes.
Wow.
Hi, how are you today?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
That's all it really takes. Yeah. And it's often those experiences that we start just in conversation that inspire us to say, hey, I'd like to learn a little bit more. There's a whole lot out there that I'd like to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the best way to do that is to join a Sister Cities program or to participate in an activity or do something with the local chamber or see what kind of meetup group there is in which I can integrate.
Right.
I remember a couple of times going to some meetings that were clearly for people who spoke French or who spoke Ukrainian or who spoke something else, and my husband would say, why are you going? You don't understand them anyway. And I'd say, because people always find a way to speak.
Yes, to
my husband once accompanied me to Moscow when I was the keynote speaker at a meeting many years later, and we were sitting in the corporate offices of this company, and there were visitors there from Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Turkmenistan, all in the Central Asian republics of the Russian Federation. They spoke not one word of Russian. My husband's Russian was limited to da and niet.
Okay.
And he said niet much more often than he said da. And yet he was able to sit there and have a healthcare administration discussion with these chief doctors for 45 minutes without me, using gestures and using all kinds of things to indicate, sometimes stick figure pictures, what they were talking about. And it was probably, he says, the most rewarding experience he's ever had.
Wow.
And he loved it.
Sometimes it's humbling too, because you realize how difficult it is to communicate and you have to be creative. So sometimes it can be humbling because you realize you can't communicate with this person.
Exactly. And think about us, okay? I'm sitting here with you and yes, we can see and we can speak and we can hear, but what about those among us who cannot?
Right.
And there are so many. They always find other senses, other sources, other ways in which to communicate.
Because when I was in Beijing, I was looking for a tea shop and I had to gesture because I didn't know enough to say what I really wanted. So.
I did that one time at a flea market in Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I did it many times, but my most rewarding experience was at a flea market in Moscow. And no one spoke a word of English except that they had a card that said MasterCard or Visa. They would always take credit cards. But generally they wanted cash and they wanted the cash to be US cash, not other cash.
Okay.
And so at the time we were teaching the International Nursing Leadership Institute, and this was a program that was a year-long learning experience, very interactive, that encouraged people to use parables and other stories to gain leadership skills. So we used three books in our program. The first one was called The Oz Principle.
Okay.
And because we were role-playing and modeling and acting out, each of the American faculty got to be one of the characters from Oz. I was the wizard, of course, because I made it happen. And so we used that book and we acted out. And initially, there were three on-site programs. The first one, we had American faculty. The second one, we had half local faculty from the countries and half American faculty. And by the third, we had all foreign faculty and the Americans were just the evaluators.
Right.
We were enjoying the whole concept and they made their own costumes and they acted out. So the first time it was the Oz Principle, the second time it was Who Moved My Cheese?
Yes, that's a good
which we've had translated into Russian and is a great book about Plan B and about contingency planning and more. The third book that we used was called Goldilocks on Management. Have you ever heard of that book?
No, I haven't heard of that one.
It's a series of parables in which the three pigs have a contingency plan, in which Goldilocks rides through, Goldilocks has not only porridge, but she also has ham to eat with her porridge. And Little Red Riding Hood rides through the forest in her red Ferrari, going to grandmother's house. She doesn't have a basket and she's not skipping along.
Mm-hmm.
She's driving a hot car and she has an MBA.
Okay.
And so I thought that one of the best ways in which to teach this concept was to use Russian matryoshkas or snacking dolls.
Okay.
And I know that they had a lot that were cartoon oriented at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to a flea market at a place called Izmailovsky Park on the outskirts of Moscow. It took four different trains to get there. And when I got there, I went up to a woman who was an elderly Russian woman and she was hosting this wonderful stand filled with all kinds of beautiful Matryoshkas, hand-painted, beautiful. Mm-hmm. Some 5 pieces, some 7, some 20. And I said, Izviniti minya, pozhalosta. Ya hachu, krasnaya shapochka I malenki dievochka. And, because I didn't know how to say wolf. So what I was saying to her was, excuse me, I'd like to have a little girl with a red hood.
Okay. For a little red hood.
So she got that part, but I didn't know wolf. So I said, like that. And she laughed and handed me a Red Riding Hood. Matryoshka, the last one, the last stacking doll was the wolf.
Oh,
it was perfect. She knew exactly what I wanted. So when you talk about being able to act out or to role play or to find a way to communicate, I knew enough words to say, excuse me, please.
Mm-hmm.
That much I could get down. I knew that a Malenki Dievochka was a little girl. And I knew Krasnaya was red, like Krasnaya Ploshet, red square. And a Shapochka is a hat. And when I explained that, she started to smile, but when I made the wolf sound,
she knew exactly what
she got me, and she started to applaud, and she was so excited because she understood what I was talking about. And I was so excited because
you're proud
I had made
of yourself,
myself
you know?
Clear.
Yes, yes.
I still have that stacking doll, that same set. It meant a lot to me. It was one of my first solo shopping trips, and I was so proud that I had paid a good price for it. Everything is all about bargaining like it is in Mexico and in other countries. I never liked the thrill of the bargain. I always wanted to pay the whole price because I thought that the person needed the money more than I did and that I would be helping the local economy to do so. But I'll never forget what a fun experience that was. And when I showed up at a meeting and I had it and everyone looked at me like, well, how did you get it? How did you buy it? That's really exciting. How did you do that? Trust me, I did it with a lot of work and a lot of resilience and a lot of tenacity and a lot of I can do this. Just give it your best shot. Hopefully she'll know what you're talking about and you'll end up with the right thing.
Wow.
Well, it was fun.
Wow. Well, I definitely thank you for the opportunity to share your experiences. You are definitely a pioneer, and especially in the medical field, as well as traveling abroad to all these different countries. So I definitely want to thank you for coming on the show.
It was my pleasure. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Have a good one.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Your Expat Expert Podcast. We would love to hear about your international experience. Email us your story to yourexpatexpert@gmail.com. Enjoy your journey because your new life is about to begin.